Oh, yay. We are just...
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 684. Madam Administrator, what's this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 684 permits the Oregon Medical Board to issue a limited license to practice medicine to physicians who are licensed in another state or country and who holds a full-time professor appointment at a school of medicine in Oregon, has an operative date of January 1, 2016, declares an emergency effective on passage. This left the Senate floor with 30 aye votes. And there's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue, and there are no amendments at this time, Mr. Chair.
Would you call a witness, please?
Yes, we have Dr. Sanjeev Kaul on the phone. Sir, please identify yourself before you start to testify.
Yeah, I'm Sanjeev Kaul. I am the Ernest Schweigart Chair of Cardiovascular Medicine, CEO of the Knight Cardiovascular Institute at OHSU.
Please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 684. 684 permits Oregon Medical Board to issue limited license to practice medicine to physicians licensed in another state or country, provided that person holds a professor appointment at a school of medicine in this state. This bill is important to help address the situation that is putting OHSU at a disadvantage in recruiting potential high-quality faculty members from elsewhere. OHSU is working hard to build a world-class academic health center to improve health and well-being of Oregonians. This means recruiting highly skilled and highly qualified faculty members from leading academic institutions in the U.S. and around the world. In the case of highly distinguished medical practitioners from overseas who have tremendous experience and expertise but do not, in some cases, have a U.S. medical degree, OHSU is at a significant disadvantage relative to other health centers and universities around the country. This is because Oregon requires all practitioners to take the three-step USMLE exam that is typically given to students in the U.S. right after graduating from medical school. This test is not an appropriate gauge of the skills of highly qualified providers and faculty members who have been practicing for many years, either here or abroad. Because Oregon requires these highly qualified and sought-after individuals to take the USMLE in order to be considered for licensure in this state, these individuals are dissuaded from even considering OHSU. Oregon is right to expect a lot from its licensed physicians and should analyze their skills and experience rigorously. The Oregon Medical Board should be able to use their experience and judgment to do this analysis in a limited number of cases when an individual is highly distinguished with significant skills and experience. SB 684 gives the Oregon Medical Board the discretion to evaluate international medical practitioners on their merits rather than simply requiring such individuals to take a test aimed at medical students. We have worked with the Oregon Medical Board in drafting this legislation, and they are ready to implement this license. I ask that you support this bill, which will help OHSU recruit the best practitioners and physician scientists from around the world to our university to serve all Oregonians. Thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Kenmore and Glamour missing.
Thank you. Are there any questions as witness? Thank you very much. If you hang on a minute, you'll hear us pass the bill, I hope. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 684 and open a work session on, I'm sorry, Senate Bill 684, and open up a work session on Senate Bill 684. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that Senate Bill 684 be sent to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 684 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hayden?
Yeah, I didn't have a chance to talk to the Oregon Medical Board about it, so I may be a no on this and reserve my right to change my vote on the floor until I have a chance to chat with them, but I have not had that opportunity yet.
All right, then I'm going to close the work session on 684. We'll get back to it later in, okay, in the day.
I'll be right back.
Thank you very much for testifying. I'm sure your bill's going to be fine.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to hang up now, doctor. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Well, yeah. Let me make a few announcements. Senate Bill 231 is going to be carried over. It's got a dash 7 amendment coming. I've had an amendment drafted that narrows the antitrust exemption. So I think a way that's acceptable, which brings it back to the work of the process specifically. So that will carry over till Friday. I'm also carrying over Senate Bill 430. We need the paperwork. Did we get a recent amendment?
We just received the amendment this morning. They're reviewing it, and I need to get the paperwork, Mr. Chair.
So we'll carry that Senate Bill 430 over till Friday. Senate Bill 705 will be carried over. It needs, it has an amendment about to come, but I don't think it's...
It hasn't come yet, has it?
We'll carry that over to Friday and see if it's ready on Friday. If not, we'll carry it over again. We have Friday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday sessions left, right? Then we can
correct
work bills.
Yes, okay. Monday, and then Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and next week.
We're going to carry over Senate Bill 833 to Friday. We have the COHO and OHA working on amendments, working on the relationship between the dash 2 and the dash 3, hoping to get a dash 4 that meets everybody's needs. So that too will be held over till Friday. And Senate Bill 880 will reschedule for the 5th, is that a...
Friday the 5th.
Reschedule that till Friday the 5th. We're not carrying that over. We will reschedule it. We have an amendment again. I mean, we have a quorum again.
Yes. Yes. So, are we back to 283?
Yeah. Let's try 283 again and see how we're doing.
Do you want to see what it is?
What's that?
Different page.
Let's open up a work session on 283. Let's stand at ease. We open a work session on Senate Bill 283. Representative Bueller, do you have some questions?
Yes, thank you. So, can you explain what's the driver in this bill? Why do we need it?
Yes. For the record, my name is Ruby Jason. I am the executive director of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. and Representative Greenlick and Bueller. The main thrust for this is because as nurses, practitioners become more mobile and are moving into our state, the license type APRN is currently used in 33 states. It is not used in Oregon. However, as nurse practitioners are moving in, the advanced practice registered nurse designation is being used by some of them in addition to the license type given to them by this state. This is for public information so that when the public sees a signature that says, you know, Mary Jones, APRN, CNA, I mean, sorry, CNS or NP, the public knows what that APRN is and that APRN is subject to the regulations of this state and is regulated by the Board of Nursing and has met certain standards. So we are not seeking licensing. We are not seeking to have any type of scope of practice differentiation. All of our title protection bills this legislative session were simply because these terms are what the public are going to run into, and the public has a right to know what qualifications allow someone to call themselves by this designation. And so, for example, as I stated in previous testimony, I've been a nurse for many, many years, have lots of certifications at the advanced level, but I am not an APRN because an APRN is really the only designated type of nurse that can diagnose, prescribe, et cetera, which is already within the Nurse Practice Act. So it's just for public protection and public knowledge.
Mm-hmm. All of it? Mm-hmm. The concern that's been expressed to me is about CRNAs, and that this would be an ability for them to substantially increase their scope of practice. Could you address that concern?
APRN is not a license type, and only license types have a scope of practice. This is just a designation of title, so it's not a license type. So if the CRNA is still bound to practice under the license type of CRNA and the scope and the standards thereof. So there is no change in scope applicable in this particular bill because there's no scope of practice associated with it. It has to go with a license type. That gives you your scope of practice. So the CRNAs remain licensed as such, as do the NPs and the CNSs, and are bound by their current scope. So it does nothing to advance anybody's scope. It's just totally for public protection, just like the word nurse. We already have registered nurse protected, and the scope of practice is under registered nurse. But since people are calling themselves nurses, and as we, again, become more mobile, we wanted to protect those terms so that the public would know exactly that these individuals are under the regulatory oversight of the Board of Nursing.
A question over here, Chair.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, so I'm still confused. So why do it if it's not a license type or that? It's just a title. I'm still not understanding the need to do this. If and that may be the case today, but if there is some future opportunity for this, I'm trying to understand again. So why even the title versus all these other license types?
Because it's being used right now. Right now, if you look up certain advanced practice nurses, they will say that they are an advanced practice registered nurse licensed by the state of Oregon as a nurse practitioner or a clinical nurse specialist or a CRNA. And when that is allowed as part of their signature block, and it allows the public to know what in the world's an APRN and what does that really mean? And so we want to make sure that only those individuals that fit the national accepted definition of an APRN use that signature block.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to understand. So it's being used.
Yes.
But so under what basis are they using it now if we don't have a license that recognizes it? I'm just trying to understand.
Because it is something that has been on a national consensus basis, been adopted by many nurses who are CRNAs, who are NPs, who are CNSs. It's already been adopted because it is a national consensus body. It's just that Oregon has not taken the step of licensing them, nor can I predict if and when the board is going to want to do that. That would be a legislative issue. But we are seeing more and more nurses move into the state that use that as their signature block. And right now, again, anybody can call themselves a nurse. I can call, you know, my neighbor can call themselves Nurse Jones if they want, because there's no prohibition against it. And so all of our licensing, all of our title protection bills are namely just to let the public know that when someone signs their name like that, that's what they're buying.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd like to comment on this. I had a discussion with an advocate earlier today, and I said, is there anything wrong with the bill? No, there's nothing wrong with the bill, but something might happen later, and I'd like something in the bill that says nothing will happen later. Well, I mean, nothing's going to happen. I mean, if something's going to happen later, it's going to happen later. The fear was that the certified nurse anesthetist will expand their scope of practice. And I haven't heard anybody suggest that, but that's what the fear was. And I said, well, do you think this bill does? No, this bill doesn't do it. No question about that. But we'd like to put something that tells legislatures in the future you can't do it. Yep.
I think beyond telling legislatures you can't do it, the further you combine the two, I don't know what the right, well, let's just use terms, nurse practitioner, CRNAs, the further that you blend the two usage of those terms together under a broader umbrella, the less distinct they are, even though one's in acute care, one's in chronic care, they're trained differently. But having them under the same umbrella is what I think is leading, umbrella title, is what's leading to the concern, rightly or wrongly, that the two are going to be conflated together, and that all of a sudden a CRNA is going to get NP-like privileges, since, hey, we're using the same title now, why can't we also use the same tools, like prescribing drugs? And that's where the concern is that the title leads to blending the two in ways that currently the scopes separate, but that the title becomes an argument for expanding the scope.
But it doesn't. I mean, might it in the future? Might that be one of the arguments? I mean,
don't know.
There are a whole set of advanced practice nurses, right? There's clinical nurse specialists, nurse practitioners, CNRAs. Any others?
No, that's it. Certified nurse midwives, but they are classified in this state as nurse practitioners.
Yeah, they're also nurse practitioners. I mean, these. All right.
Wait, sir.
Representative Bueller had a question.
Representative Bueller.
I think Representative Klum kind of expressed what I was going to try to draw out. So just for clarification, so a CRNA could not practice in a chronic care setting with the title of APRN?
A CRNA, Representative Bueller, a CRNA can only practice within the scope of their education and their competency validation and their current scope of practice. If I cannot tell you what the board or any executive director in the future is going to request of the state legislators. Mm-hmm. Today, we are only here to protect those titles. There has been no discussion in these bills about any scope of practice expansion. A CRNA, a CNS, or a NP have to practice within their current scope and in their area of education and competency validation. Will never change.
Even if they're just using the APRN title?
They are still bound by their license type. Because the license type describes the scope of practice. You can call them anything you want, but they're still considered licensed CRNAs who must abide by their scope.
Is that a note?
I think that was well stated.
Was there a camera?
Yeah. Sorry I got in late. I was testifying in another hearing, so I missed part of this. I guess, though, and related to your comment, is that the CRNA is trained in a very different fashion from the NP. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Representative Chair Greenlick and Representative Kennemer, they are. They are educated much differently. They have a much different and rigorous education process, plus significantly different education, continuing education requirements and practice requirements. So they have, again, their own scope and under their own license. And there are those that are calling themselves APRNs because they have come from other states where that was their, that's how they signed their name. And again, it is here. And the mobility of it is what we're trying to address here.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 283. Mm-hmm. And carry it over till Wednesday.
Friday.
Till Friday. See if we can have a whole committee here on Friday.
So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 on this one. Representative Noss has to leave at 2.
Sanities.
I'm back.
Ortiz.
Nine.
Okay, there you go.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 916. Where do we have that on this one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 916A directs the Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Medical Board, and the Oregon State Board of Nursing to study clinical guidance and health outcomes relating to Lyme disease and report to the Legislative Assembly by March 1, 2016. This left the Senate floor with 24 ayes, 6 noes, no revenue, and there's a fiscal impact statement. And the fiscal impact is basically indeterminate. And we have a couple of panels, Mr. Chair.
Okay, would you call the first panel, please?
Teresa Denham, Dr. Steve Hepp, and Dr. Marty Ross.
Please introduce yourself and you begin testifying.
My computer. Honorable representatives and honorable Committee on Health Care, thank you for hearing us on SB 916. My name is Teresa Denham, for the record. In 1991, my daughter was bit by a tick. She became progressively ill over a period of 10 years. We saw over 18 specialists for her conditions, and by reaching her teen years, she suffered crippling arthritis, congestive heart failure, multiple daily seizures, a TIA, and many, many complications that led to many hospitalizations. She was finally diagnosed with Lyme disease in the fall of 2001, but her diagnosis was quickly overturned by OHSU infectious disease, stating the test was a false positive. They did not offer to examine her, and no treatment was ever offered. The protocol allowed in Oregon does not allow for this diagnosis and therefore the subsequent treatment because our guidelines are so narrow and restrictive. We were only able to get care for our daughter outside of the state using an ILADS protocol, which is approved by the IOM grade criteria. In December of 2001, I began the Oregon Lyme Disease Network as a mother of a severely infected child, networking with others to prevent similar suffering. We are now a patient advocate group with 5 statewide support groups because this disease affected many more than we ever envisioned. 14 years and over 1,500 patients later, there is one irrefutable fact that stands out. The patients who have the financial means to travel out of Oregon and receive the ILADS care are significantly better than those who do not. And I say significantly better because those who receive ILADS care often become fully functional and symptom-free, while the balance who receive care here in Oregon tend to degenerate to complete disability. The Triple Aim initiatives in the Oregon Shares creates access to quality and reliable care, reduces the cost, and improves health. And since Lyme disease causes chronic disease, we can meet the goal two in that initiative of the triple aim if we can restructure how Oregon diagnoses and treats Lyme disease to other evidence-based standards. We have proposed that Oregon allow physicians to use any protocols that are created either under the Institute of Medicine or the National Clearinghouse Guidelines criteria in the diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease. The Center of Disease Control clearly acknowledges that the IOM GRADE criteria delivers unbiased, generally authoritative protocols developed with evidence-based medicine and a patient-centered outcome goal. And those are the goals we want here in Oregon as well. Currently, the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society meets the IOM GRADE criteria. And the infectious disease meets the IDSA and GC criteria. And therefore, it's our belief that both of those should be allowed here in Oregon. Confirmed cases of Lyme disease in 2013 were only 43. But this seems to be a significant underestimation of what it really is, and the consequences in this state have been severe. If we normalize the CDC data to the veterinary data across the country, we could believe that there is an incidence of 400 to 800 new cases per year. And I hear the same story as a support group leader over and over again. And that is when somebody gets a tick bite, they go to a doctor, and their doctor says, I don't think it's here. I don't think we need to test because our reporting criteria that goes back to the state is not reflective of what we're really seeing. A survey of our Oregon patients that come to me, 70% of the 105 surveyed were disabled prior to their diagnosis with Lyme disease. And those diagnoses cost... Those diagnoses were primarily sentences of neurological diseases like MS, ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, autism, arthritis, cardiac issues, and more. And the cost of those misdiagnoses result up to $60,000 a year per chronically ill person per year until they die. In the case of misdiagnosed Lyme disease, when the patient is effectively treated, they can recover and return to a fulfilling life that is productive. The average cost of treatment is roughly $10,600 a year for an average of 2 to 3 years. It's clear that the narrow, restrictive current guidelines in Oregon are not working, and they're costing the states hundreds of thousands of dollars in social care, medical care, and patient productivity of the patients. And this isn't just about the unnecessary burden of cost to Oregon. It's also about the patients who are suffering. And I hope you'll take time to hear the SB 916 oral testimony that we did for the Senate floor, because that testimony, we had 17 patients speak. Those who got ILADS care are well, like myself and like my daughter, and those who were unable to leave the state for various reasons and could not obtain care here in Oregon have become disabled. Our organization would like to thank you for supporting us in this venture to find a mechanism to create a better health outcome for these patients. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer any. What do you want done with the prepared testimony?
Have you not given it in before?
His testimony was not presented.
He'll take it.
Okay. Thank you.
It'll be on the computer system.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I'm Dr. Marty Ross. I'm an ILADS-trained physician who treats chronic Lyme disease from Seattle, Washington. You may wonder why I'm here today. Well, the reason I'm here is that I have to treat people with Lyme from Oregon because there are not medical doctors in the state that will do so. The reason for this is due to a hostile environment that has been created by the medical board and the health authority that has been known to remove licenses of doctors that have either diagnosed Lyme or have treated Lyme.
Do you have any evidence that? Have you got the cases of those people?
Do we have that?
We have them presented on
It's in the written record.
There are licenses that were taken away?
One doctor is on the record in the OLIS. There are other doctors who we have heard were censured in their license, so restricted.
But the one doctor in OLIS had his license taken away because he treated people with Lyme disease?
Yes, that is. And we have it in the record under SB 916 exhibits.
Let me go ahead and proceed here. It's a very good question. Thank you for that. So one thing that I do want you to know what Lyme disease is. So Lyme disease is a political illness, which is why we're before your committee. And I have to say it's a political illness throughout the country, also in my state of Washington. Lyme disease also is a medical mess that gets created after a tick bite when a tick transmits a number of germs, including the Lyme germ, into a person. This infection, if not treated within the first month of a tick bite, leads to debilitating illness that is as severe as congestive heart failure where somebody's heart is not working. It causes a whole host of medical problems that Teresa already outlined for you, and I won't go into those. But the biggest ones are debilitating mental problems, cognition issues, severe fatigue, body pains, and a whole host of other ones. Right now, part of the problem in Oregon is that there is a denial that the problem exists. Your health authority and the medical board claims that ticks in Oregon do not carry Lyme in sufficient numbers. And yet we know from studies by UC Davis down in California that up to 40% of ticks in Northern California carry Lyme. And I assure you, ticks do not know borders. The other problem in Oregon regarding reporting of the illness is that medical doctors are not adequately trained to diagnose the problem because they don't even think to look for it because they're told by your health authorities that it's not here. Secondly, they're not trained to diagnose it because they falsely believe that you need a positive test to diagnose it, which you do not, that you have to have a known tick bite, which you do not, and that you have to have a certain type of rash called a bullseye rash, which you do not. The do-nots that I just talked about are actually based upon the United States Centers for Disease Control criterion that says you need none of these. And yet in Oregon, my experience from talking with my patients is that they have been told time and time again, you didn't have a rash, you didn't have a tick bite, you don't have positive testing, you do not have Lyme disease.
Well, you'll have to excuse me. I'm sort of trained in the old model. You don't have a tick bite, you don't have any symptoms, you don't have any rash. You don't meet any diagnostic criteria, but you have Lyme disease. And there are 500 a year, so there's probably 3 a year in Oregon. And how does the mystical diagnosis of not having Lyme disease, not having any symptoms, diagnosis?
What the Centers for Disease Control says is look at symptoms and look at risk of getting it. In addition, do consider testing. Testing, it will find Lyme if you have it about 80 to 85% of the time if it's done with a type of test called a Western blot. However, the steps that are called for by most health authorities and a group called the Infectious Disease Society of America says to do something called a two-step test, which is part one, do something called an ELISA that looks to say, in your body, do you have antibodies that could be against Lyme? Doesn't say they are, but could be. You have to have a positive test there before you can do the confirmatory test called a Western blot. The ELISA will only find Lyme if you have it 50% of the time, and there are numerous studies that actually show that fact. So even in Oregon, if they follow the two-step process recommended by the CDC and the health authority here, it will miss it approximately 50% of the time. So you have to go on what clinical criterion shows you, and you have to think, is there a risk my patient could have gotten it? Are they a deer hunter on the coast of Oregon, for instance? Do they do a lot of outdoor activities? Have they seen ticks on their dogs before? Maybe they've never seen it on them. So you have to put the whole picture together, basically. Can I proceed then?
Please.
Yeah, okay. So part of the problem is in treating Lyme is that we have two standards of care. There's a standard that has been promoted by the Infectious Disease Society of America that says if you have Lyme disease, it is always easily treated with 1 month of antibiotics. And yet there are numerous animal and human studies that show that that germ easily lives beyond 1 month of antibiotics. And yet they refuse to pay attention to that. They believe that if somebody still has symptoms after the 30 days of treatment, that this is something called post-Lyme syndrome that is basically the result of an autoimmune illness triggered by the Lyme infection. And if you look at some studies about the effectiveness of their 30-day treatment, 60% of people will still have symptoms beyond the 30 days. There is another standard of care that is not followed by the medical board in the state, nor even in my state of Washington, for instance, in many other areas, which is a standard put out by ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. What the ILADS standard says is if somebody has been treated for 30 days and they remain ill, consider still treating. But you should do so based upon describing to your patients the risk and benefits of treating. You need to involve them in the decision. The IDSA guidelines are largely opinion. If you look at what their findings are, over 50% are based on opinion. They have no scientific foundation behind them. The ILADS guidelines are evidence-based. They do have science that supports them, and even so, they are largely ignored by medical boards. What we're asking in being here before you, and I am asking in being here before you today, is that you consider having the medical board use these guidelines when it's considering whether to discipline a person or not for treating Lyme disease. I ask that you consider this because many Oregonians are having to go out of state to see people like me that follow the ILADS guidelines. In my practice, I have over 100 or more patients currently from Oregon, and that's just this year. I've been treating chronic Lyme disease for 10 years, and probably over that time I've had thousands that have come to see me with this illness. Your people in the state are going to California too.
About 500 a year nationwide.
I'm sorry?
Did we hear the incidence was 500 a year nationwide?
The incidence, actually, a new estimate put out earlier this year, actually in late 2014 by the United States Centers for Disease Control, estimates now 300,000 new cases annually. And many of us...
Went from 500 to 300,000?
Ms. Denham was telling you about estimates for Oregon. National estimates are more at about 300,000, and most of us believe that is still underreported by perhaps 10%, actually. This is actually a growing epidemic that's largely being underlooked and also is not being adequately handled. I want you to know that your citizens that come see me are terribly disabled, and that once they do go through treatment with me or other doctors that follow similar approaches that I use, many are able to return to productive lives. Not everyone, but most people are able to regain the ability to participate fully in their lives and their families, as well as in their work environment, too. So I ask that you consider SB 916 as it was originally written, not as a study, but actually as it was originally submitted, to have the medical board and the health authority follow or allow for the use of treatment using the ILADS guidelines. Thank you very much.
Representative Bueller?
Yes, thank you for your testimony. Can you explain what your training background is? Are you a doctor of infectious disease?
I'm a medical doctor. I'm a family physician by training. Because the infectious disease doctors largely refuse to accept this as a chronic ongoing problem, those of us in the community wind up having to take care of the people that they denied care for. So the majority of doctors in this country that actually treat chronic Lyme disease are family physicians and general internists. Because we decided to treat and see what works, and because we had to take care of the patients, it's easy for the infectious disease doctors to say no, but they're not having to see these people back in their office again and again and again. And so therefore, those of us have come up with ways, looked at the science, looked beyond the opinions, and I will say that's opinion. If you look at the IDSA standards, 50% of their decisions were opinion-based. They get a category rating of C, which means they're opinion-based findings. They're not based on science.
A couple of follow-ups, please. Can you explain your research? You're making claims about the success of your treatment protocols. Can you give me the results of your research on your treatment protocols?
There, in terms of the information that I gave in my testimony, this is based on common, how can I say this? In Lyme disease, there, unfortunately, are limited studies that have been done. There have only been four studies that have been done of high quality looking at outcomes. I'm going to come to your answer in a minute. When we say a high quality study, it's something called a double-blind randomized controlled study, which means people are randomized to get a placebo or an active agent. They don't know who got what. They're blind. The researchers collecting information over here don't know who got what. They're blind. No one can bring their biases into it. There's only been four of those studies done. And my side, those of us that believe there is chronic Lyme disease, look at that science and say that three of them showed improvement. The infectious disease doctors look at that and they say none of them showed improvement. And as we often do in medicine, we can get into arguments over interpretation of science.
I want to know your results. I want to know you're making a lot of claims about how you're treating patients and you have a very large practice. I want to hear your results, just not your anecdotal experience.
So my results are based on discussions with other colleagues that follow similar protocols to me. We don't have the science, which is what I'm trying to tell you. And what I observe in my practice is that with treatment, and this is observation because the science has not been done, regrettably, even for the infectious disease doctor's opinion, the science is not that great. What I find in my practice and among my colleagues is that with treatment, 90% of people can get benefit. Those improvements can range up to 100%. An average treatment length is 2 years.
So basically, you want to take the treatment of this condition back 30 years to observational anecdotal experience and ignore the results of double-blind clinical trials.
As I said, my interpretation of those double-blind randomized studies and those of my colleagues actually says that three of those studies showed benefit. You have to realize the longest study that was done, though, was only 3 months.
But you want to take us back to observational studies.
I want to take it forward to using clinical approaches when science fails us. That's what we have to do in our offices. We have moved towards evidence, so-called evidence-based medicine. But what do we do when the science hasn't been done?
You do more science before you start treating thousands of
people. People can't wait. And with treatment, what we know by observation, which is what we have to do when the science isn't there, we know that they get better. Ms. Denham is a case of that, and I could give you numbers of examples of people that have had improvement with treatment when they have been denied care by infectious disease doctors.
Can you tell me what that ILADS guidelines is? How do you typically treat people?
What the ILADS guidelines calls for, there's three parts to it. Number one, what to do in the case of an acute tick bite. ILAD says treat for about 3 weeks with antibiotics. The Infectious Disease Society says give a single dose of doxycycline. And I could get into the arguments about why that's a bad idea for a single dose.
I don't want the arguments. I just want to know what the guidelines are.
Okay. Second step in the ILADS guidelines says that for acute Lyme, treat for 30 days with antibiotics. And it gives some recommendations of which ones to use.
What's acute Lyme? It means approximate to the
acute Lyme means having Lyme that develops symptoms within 30 days of a tick bite. That's a rough explanation of what it would be. But usually it means you have the known tick bite or you are in an area where it's known to be a lot of ticks and you develop flu-like illness, headaches, you might get the rash, you have symptoms of Lyme, which tends to look more like a flu-like illness actually at first. All right, the third part of the ILADS guideline says if you have a person that has Lyme, you have the option to treat them with antibiotics in 6 week intervals and you come back and you relook at what is happening with those antibiotics every 6 weeks. But you talk with the patient, you get informed consent, you say to them, look, we don't have great science here, but you have an option. I will keep treating you, but you need to know there may be risk of the antibiotics and you need to compare those against the risk of having this illness and not doing anything about it. And you test periodically to make sure their bodies are handling the antibiotics okay. You also, in my practice, I'm also an integrative medicine doctor, which means I work both with drugs and I work with natural medicines as well, too. So while I'm using the antibiotics, I'm also often working with herbal medicines that give the ability to actually support the body, too. Now, the ILADS guidelines doesn't specifically say herbs. It says use whatever you need to, but explain to your patient, get consent, and work as long as you keep seeing improvement.
So another follow-up, please.
I think we need to move on, but why don't you take one follow-up? Okay.
And who's against? I mean, I don't understand why anyone would be against prolonged use of antibiotics if you have consent from a patient and the physician thinks that's the right treatment. So why is this such a crucial?
There have been books written on this, unfortunately. I wish I had an easy answer. If you were to want to do some reading, I'd just suggest there's a book called Cure Unknown by a writer named Pamela Weintraub, who used to be...
I don't appreciate that. I'm a physician myself, and I'm very much aware that I can treat someone with antibiotics as long a duration as I think is effective.
So. In Oregon, you cannot. Your medical board will come in and probably you up for investigation.
That's nonsense.
There will be other people on this
I'm
panel.
Treated chronically with antibiotics. I've for treated.
No, I said for Lyme. I'm sorry. Let me clarify that. For a Lyme infection. We have a member. I think we have a following member of this panel that would say otherwise, actually, based on her experience.
Let's move on. Yes. You got it.
And actually, good luck. Yeah. I don't have any prepared. Is this working?
Yes.
I don't have prepared written testimony.
Record.
For the record,
Your name.
Stephen Heppe, Dr. Stephen Heppe.
Okay.
It's a doctor of science, not a doctor of medicine. Thank you. I would like to correct just one possible misconception that may have occurred a few minutes ago. None of us are suggesting that we should not do good science. In fact, everyone that you will hear today is strongly in favor of additional science, additional studies, going out, doing tick sweeps, getting more science. The science on this disease is woefully inadequate and needs to be improved. And we all support better science. The issue, however, is that at this point we have a large cohort of very ill people in the state that cannot get treatment in the state. And most of the people you will hear today have personal stories, and we have personal stories. We cannot get treated here in Oregon. My wife was very ill. Two of my children were extremely ill. None of us could get treated here in Oregon. We went to California. This is a serious problem. The science needs to be improved, but also the health delivery system needs to be improved. And if you have questions for me, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you very much.
Control the next panel, please.
Dr. Heather Kahn, Chris Chitka, Beth Schultz. And then we have one after that.
Who's after that?
Sharon Lee.
Beth Schultz is not here.
Oh, Beth Schultz is not here?
No.
Okay, then we can go to Sharon Lee. So that's Dr. Heather Kahn, Chris Chitka, and Sharon Lee.
My name came. I'm Dr. Heather Kahn. My name came first. Would you like me to go first?
Any order.
Okay. Honorable representatives, I'm Dr. Heather Elaine Kahn. I live in Josephine County. I'm a general practitioner. Possibly all diseases could walk through my door. I've seen a group of tick-borne illnesses that concern me, and it's not just Lyme disease. I'm seeing a group of organisms, Mycoplasma, Ehrlichia, Coxiella, Bartonella, Chlamydia, Babesia, viruses, and others. The symptoms of these illnesses are vague, and they mimic many diseases, and they have a multitude of complaints. Malaise, joint pain, twitching, mood changes, vision changes, night sweats, sinus pressure, cough, sore throat. A patient can have a rash or not. If not diagnosed and treated, there can be devastated consequences for the patient, worsening debility and pain. Patients treated promptly heal sooner. Rapid diagnostic tests are not available. Testing is expensive and inaccurate at early stages of disease. Testing for all possible infections in patients with vague complaints would cost thousands of dollars per patient. Tick-borne illness diagnosis at early stages is clinical. Clinical judgment is based on history and physical examination. Tick-borne illness incidence is underreported. Medical providers are required to report positive cases by blood work. The classic bullseye rash, occurring in 50 to 60% of patients with Lyme disease, is not reportable or tracked by Oregon. When providers see this rash, we treat for Lyme disease, tick-borne illness, and we don't need blood work to do it. I see a failure in the diagnosis and treatment of these diseases, which disturbs me. I follow Oregon guidelines for treatment of tick-borne illnesses. Some of my patients get better, and some do not. Oregon guidelines are most effective if diagnosis is made early, which is not always the case. Some CDC-positive Lyme patients have been refused treatment by Oregon physicians. I see a multitude of diseases as a general practitioner. Patients come to me first when they're ill. I am the gatekeeper of medicine. I would like to use broader evidence-based guidelines for the diagnosis and treatment of tick-borne illnesses than Oregon allows, and better education for providers. Some patients get better with Oregon's guidelines. Some do not. Some patients are treated out of state and get better. Some providers in Oregon are unaware of tick-borne illnesses and miss clinical presentation of the disease. Some patients with positive blood work for these diseases are not being treated adequately. I care about the people of Josephine County and the state of Oregon. What is happening with tick-borne illness saddens me. I believe we could provide more effective tracking, diagnosis, and treatment if allowed to use broader guidelines than offered by the state of Oregon. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask me.
Where are those Oregon guidelines?
Let's say again.
The Oregon guidelines?
They're from the Infectious Disease Society of America.
That's not an Oregon guideline. You said you're bound by Oregon guidelines. I was wondering where those Oregon guidelines come from.
The guidelines are from what would be considered the standard of care for the state of Oregon. When I contact insurance companies. When I contact insurance companies and wish to extend treatment.
I understand insurance guidelines, but you mentioned Oregon guidelines and you said doctors are bound by Oregon guidelines. I'd like to know where those guidelines are, because I don't know any Oregon guidelines that bind doctors.
Well, I'd like to know where they are too, I got to be honest.
Okay, so following guidelines, you don't know where they are?
The insurance companies keep bringing them up. And I would like to be able to extend antibiotic treatment longer for some patients. But the insurance companies say no. They're by the Oregon guidelines. And then they show me the Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines and state that that's what it is for the state. So I've had that happen to me.
The problem is insurance companies, not the medical board. We heard testimony that doctors are delicensed because of...
I don't have any of that information. The only information is what I have personally experienced, and what I have personally experienced is more difficulty with insurance companies. I have heard through hearsay that physicians have been disciplined, but I don't know
anything. If a patient comes in with self-pay, you're going to treat them differently than somebody with insurance, is that right?
If someone comes in self-pay, I'm going to treat them differently. I have to say, because of gossip and hearsay, I treat them according to what the insurance company guidelines or what the insurance companies have been suggesting to me, and suggest that if they want to be treated longer out of fear from insurance companies and fear from gossip from my medical board, that I suggest that they either see an infectious disease specialist, that I can't extend beyond that, mainly because I don't really know everything that's going on with Lyme disease. I'm seeing conflicting medical messages from the Infectious Disease Society of America. I am seeing other guidelines from the infected, from ILADS, from the Institute of Medicine. I am seeing from the CDC website the incidence of Lyme disease that's not consistent with my clinical experience. I personally believe that the state of Oregon needs to take a look at what is happening with Lyme disease in the state of Oregon, and seriously.
But you mean Oregon insurance companies now, or what do you mean?
I mean the entire state. Today, as I was driving up here, I was talking to a neurosurgeon, and he said, "What are you doing coming up to Salem?" And I said, "Well, I want to talk about Lyme disease. We've got it there in Josephine County." And he said, "Heather, we've got Lyme disease here." And I said, "You're joking, right?" And he said, "No, I didn't know that." And I said, "Yeah. We get it here. It's in our ticks." And he said, "Thank you for letting me know." And I said, "Well, you're welcome. Think about it now when you see patients and consider it in your differential diagnosis."
I'm curious, do you also treat patients with Lyme disease like Dr. Ross with otobar bark extract and cat's claw?
No, I do not.
So why do you differ from his protocol of treatment?
I am a general practitioner, and I have a choice. I can continue to be a general practitioner, or I can subspecialize. I love general practice. I am not interested in having a clinic that specializes in the treatment of Lyme disease. I have had patients ask me to do that because I am aware of Lyme disease, but that is not where I want to go with my career.
So you don't agree that that's the right treatment for Lyme's disease, otobark extract and cat's claw?
I am unaware of that treatment. Oh. I am not an expert in the treatment of Lyme. I am telling you what I am seeing on the ground in Josephine County.
Mr. Kenner?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make a suggestion. When people speak in the mic too close, it reverberates and it makes it very difficult to hear you. So if you sit back 6 feet, 6 inches to a foot, six inches to a foot or so, we'll much better sound.
I'm sorry.
I should have intervened earlier, but it just helps to hear what you're saying. It comes out much clearer.
All right. Can we have the next witness, please?
All right. Hello, my name is Chris Chitka, and this is my beautiful wife, Kara, and we are here in support of Senate Bill 916. In 2001, at the age of 23, my wife's fine motor skills started to deteriorate. Her speech started to slur, and she had extreme joint pain and difficulty walking. She saw her primary care physician, and they did not consider the possibility of Lyme disease, even though she had recently spent 3 weeks in New York. We were referred to neurologists, and after months of testing, the doctor at the MDA clinic diagnosed her with ALS. His parting words of wisdom were to go home, make your wife comfortable, get her a wheelchair, and don't let her hold her children if you are worried about dropping them. Kara, being a stubborn Italian, did not accept his advice and instead started doing her own research on ALS. In doing so, she found others who were diagnosed with ALS who were later diagnosed with Lyme. Kara contacted one of these people that lived in Texas. He himself was an MD. He gave her the name and contact information of the doctor who had diagnosed him. We later contacted that doctor and asked if there was an MD close to us in Oregon, and he was not aware of one. So we traveled to San Francisco to see him. After getting tested and having CDC positive tests, we started treatment for Lyme and co-infections. We worked with a new primary care physician in Oregon in concert with the California doctor, and Kara got treatment for 1 year. After that 1 year, the primary care physician here in Oregon was told by the infectious disease doctors and neurologists that it was impossible for her to have Lyme disease. With increasing pressure from those doctors, our primary care physician stopped treatment, even though Kara was showing signs of improvement. After her treatment stopped, Kara began to go downhill fast. As care continued to get worse, she required 24-hour care. In 2008, I had to quit my job and as apprentice pipe fitter to stay home and care for her full-time. Luckily, the state has a program that allowed me to stay home and care for her and raise our children. Since Kara was infected with Lyme and we were not able to get the correct treatment early on, I had to quit my job, suffered with emotional and physical health problems, including gaining 100 pounds. Our three children have suffered mentally and have undergone years of therapy and missed out on Kara being there for many milestones in their lives. The people we called our friends all disappeared. Our family quit visiting and calling, leaving us alone and isolated. We strongly believe that if we would have gotten early treatment, since with the year of treatment she had received, she showed signs of improvement, she might have had a different income outcome and would have been able to be a contributing member of society. We would still have our friends and family, and our three children would have a healthy and able-bodied mother in their lives. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, representatives, for hearing my testimony. My name is Sharon Lee. I've been an RN for 50 years, now retired in Oregon. And I've been sick with Lyme disease since 1978. I still have the Lyme disease in my system, even though I've been treated for 13 years with antibiotics. I had a culture last year. It was positive for the Lyme Borrelia burgdorferi organism. Lyme disease has been a nationally notifiable condition in the United States since 1991. To help monitor the spread and number of Lyme cases, the CDC put out what is called a surveillance case definition. Their definition of Lyme was based on the early findings and hasn't changed any since that time. Over the years, the CDC has transformed their Lyme criteria, which it was initially developed for surveillance purposes, into diagnostic mandates for physicians. In fact, most physicians believe the patient must meet the criteria of the early CDC definition for a diagnosis to be made. This is not true. The CDC definition was never meant to be used as a checklist for clinical diagnosis of Lyme, but unfortunately, that is exactly what has happened. As a result, many patients are not diagnosed early or are misdiagnosed and subsequently go on to a chronic state of disease, like myself. The main reason for this limitation is the current CDC protocol required for confirmation. The CDC supports their testing criteria, even though many studies have demonstrated the tests lack sensitivity and miss from 50 to 75% of cases. This protocol requires, number one, presence of a bullseye or what we call an erythema migrans rash. Number two, a culture or a two-tiered testing protocol and documentation of several symptoms indicating advanced disease. Since I'm a former public health nurse, I've often followed policies issued by my state when reviewing infectious disease cases. I retrieve guidelines from the Oregon Department of Health about who should be counted as a positive case of Lyme disease. Much to my dismay, I found the guidelines from Oregon to be even more restrictive than the CDC. The Oregon Department of Health confines confirmation to only two items. Number one, a physician-documented rash that has to be over 2 inches in size, and a culture or a positive two-tiered testing protocol. Nothing else is ever taken into account, according to their guidelines. I have yet to see the language also that the Oregon Department of Health outlines for Lyme disease. In fact, it was really hard for me to read the overtly flippant remark contained in their criteria. Thus, reduced sensitivity, i.e., exclusion of some reports that seem real, is the inevitable result. Get over it. Most reportable cases will be presumptive. I can see where these remarks alone could set the tone for any public health officials to discount criteria to support a confirmed case. I can also see that due to these restrictive guidelines, very few confirmed cases will be reported to the CDC. Be aware that the guidelines set by the Oregon Department of Health are those that have left many misdiagnosed and untreated. It seems odd to me that the public health agencies, whose usual importance is on prevention, have actually placed a burden on the medical care system. I suggest the criteria and guidelines for confirming and counting cases of Lyme disease in Oregon should be reviewed and revised. In addition, not all cases reported in Oregon by either the patient's physician or the testing lab, which is also required to report it, receive proper follow-up by the Oregon Department of Health officials. In 2014, one CDC proficient lab called Igenics in California, which is a tick-dedicated lab, reported to Oregon Lyme Disease Network they had reported 166 positive CDC test results for Lyme disease to the Oregon Department of Health. But during that same year, the Oregon Department of Health only reported 31 cases to the CDC. This is a huge discrepancy. In another survey conducted by ourselves in the Southern Oregon Lyme Disease Support Group of 56 members, 24 people met the criteria based on lab results alone, but only 4 were contacted by Oregon Department of Health officials for follow-up, and none of the positive lab reports that were done by Igenics Lab were ever followed up, not one. No wonder physicians are telling their patients that there is no Lyme disease in Oregon. It is because cases are not confirmed by the Oregon Department of Health. In conclusion, I would like to say that we at Southern Oregon Lyme Disease support the rights of patients to be advised that there is more than one evidence-based, medically recognized standard of care for Lyme disease, and that they have the right to participate in decisions pertaining to their or their children's medical care. Southern Oregon Lyme Disease strongly advocates for legislative leadership and investigation into the past and present Oregon Department of Health practices, which permit the IDSA guidelines to overly influence national and Oregon healthcare policy on Lyme disease. Thank you.
What's preventing them from having the right to be informed now?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
You say you want patients to have the right to be informed.
I want them to have the right to know what the doctor is planning to treat for them. You know, they need to be informed that there are options, not just one option for treatment.
Well, if there's a right to do something, somebody has an obligation. Is that right? Who has the obligation to make sure that right happens?
Well, I think a physician would have that right or that obligation to inform the patient. Is that what you're asking? I'm sorry.
The physician isn't willing to inform the patient about what they're being treated?
I think that most physicians are not aware that there is another guideline that they could follow.
So how does that right get implemented if their doctors don't know the answer?
Yeah, I think first they have to recognize that Lyme disease is present in Oregon. And most of the physicians that my 200-plus members have gone to don't even realize that Lyme disease is here, so they don't know to look for that.
So it's not about patient rights in that case, is it? I mean, the patient right isn't being violated by...
No, I don't think their right is being violated, but I think that the information that physicians have is not sufficient to be able to make good choices for their patients, and these patients should then be informed of what those rights, I guess you might say, are.
By whom?
By the physician.
Who don't know the answer.
Correct.
The physicians who don't have the information have the obligation to tell their patients who have a right to know something the physician doesn't know.
Well, if it all starts with the numbers, and you're starting with the public health department numbers being probably very, very low. I mean, if we have 1,500 patients in this state, yet they're only reporting a very small number, like 31 or 40 patients per year, that isn't representative of what really is happening in this state. So when the doctor goes to the Oregon Department of Health and they look at the numbers, it's easy for them to say there is no Lyme disease here or it isn't a problem here, when it really is.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions, Bill?
Quick question. So quick search, certainly not an expert in this field, but quick search with quoting CDC says there's 251 cases of confirmed Lyme disease in Oregon. Where do we get the either 1,500 or the 5,000 or the 5,000 plus 10% that we've heard during this testimony? Any quick answer on that? Sure.
I believe the 5,000, and wait, repeat your question one more time. It wasn't making a lot of sense to me.
Okay, so we've heard from the beginning of the testimony that there may be 5,000 cases in Oregon, and that was estimated to be 10% low, and then 1,500 cases in Oregon, and CDC is quoted as confirming 251 cases of Lyme disease in Oregon. Where do we get this
large variance?
I can tell
from clinical experience that when, for example, and I don't have exact numbers, but I probably in the last year had two or three CDC reportable cases of Lyme disease by blood criteria. I probably treated anywhere from 20 to 30 bullseye rashes. I do not report bullseye rashes. I'm not required to report bullseye rashes to the CDC or to the state of Oregon. There's an underreporting with regard to that. A good example would have to do with flu. Oh, sorry, you're right. Sorry. It has to do with flu. During flu season, I get a lot of patients coming in with the flu. And I can tell clinically when I look at them that you have the flu. I don't get the tests for it, so the CDC doesn't get to gather that data. I very rarely actually test for influenza. A lot of my patients have very large out-of-pocket or payments that they have to make. I say to my patients, you look like you got the flu to me. You can pay $35, $50 to get a test that's going to show that you have the flu, or you can just trust my judgment. And a lot of my patients say, all right, doc, and so there's a bullseye rash. I say to my patients, well, it's a bullseye rash. It is a classic for Lyme disease. I'm going to treat you with doxycycline. We can get blood work today, which may or may not be positive, and we could repeat blood work again in 3 months, in 6 months. If you want to pay for it out of pocket, I live in a very impoverished area. If you want to pay for that out of pocket so that I may or may not be able to report it to the CDC so that the people of the state of Oregon can gather that data, let me know. But I'm not going to pay for the test for you. If you want to pay for it so that Oregon gets to know, it's your choice, and I'm letting you know. And many of my patients say, you know, doc, I see that bullseye rash. I've got pictures of it up on the screen, on the computer. And they say, I trust you. Just, I'll take the 2 weeks to 1 month treatment of antibiotics and not pay for that test. And so that's where the underreporting comes in. Does that make sense?
So it sounds like the physicians are promoting the underreporting.
It's not necessarily promoting. It's the diagnosis of Lyme disease. In that, I can use my clinical judgment. I don't have to get blood work. The only way that the CDC gathers that data is through the blood work. And so if we change some policy possibly in Oregon where doctors can also report and Oregon can track bullseye rashes, then we may see the incidence of Lyme disease increase. Does that make sense? I'm also supposed to be a steward of appropriate healthcare spending. Well, if I know a bullseye rash is a bullseye rash and I'm going to give you doxycycline for 2 weeks or a month, yeah, it's dirt cheap. You can get it, you know, $4 at Walmart. Well, that's $4 there out of that patient's out-of-pocket expense. Or I can have them get these repeat testings, and I give informed consent to my patient. And it is not my decision to make. I tell my patient, this is the informed consent. You can take the antibiotics for $4 from me, or we can do this series of testing. It's going to be $35 1 month. You're going to do another $35 in 3 and maybe another $35 in 6 months. But it's going to come out of your pocket. It's your choice. I've informed you of it. What do you want to do? Then my patients most of the time go, I'll just take the $4 antibiotic. But I'm not required to report that because the state of Oregon doesn't track it. And so that's where you see that inconsistency in what I see on the ground and then what we see reported to the state.
But you could provide the testing.
If the patient wants to pay for it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all of you that came so far to testify on this. I know it's a very important issue for you. I really appreciate your concern and your willingness to come down and talk to us about it.
Can I just make a comment? Can I make a quick comment?
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just add my thanks. My daughter's boyfriend has been going through this for the last year and a half. He's gone through now months of treatment because it was at least a couple years old and had to send his, you know, he went off to Yale and to a bunch of different places to kind of get the expertise that he needed. I have another friend that was totally debilitated and went through a very alternative kind of treatment that involved drinking peroxide and a whole bunch of stuff to deal with this. It actually did cure him. I think there's a lot of questions out there about how to appropriately take care of this, so I'm very eager to support anything that will need more research.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 684. Senate Bill 684.
No, 916.
Hold on.
916.
Senate Bill 916. Senate Bill 916. I'm going to open a work session again to get some testimony on Senate Bill 684. Scott Gallant, will you join us?
Chairman Scott Gallant, for the record, representing the Oregon Medical Board.
There were some questions about the medical board's reaction to this bill. Can you help us on it?
Medical board worked with OHSU on the language. We're good with the bill. It is a mechanism to enable OHSU to have very, very worldwide qualified physicians work at OHSU. So the bill, from our perspective, is good to go, sir.
Is there mechanisms for the board to determine who will or won't get one of these licenses?
Yes, sir. They will do it by rule, by typical standards of making sure that they're qualified to practice in Oregon at the institution.
Representative Bueller.
Scott, I'm sensitive to the concern that's being addressed or OHSU's concern, but the country of origin causes me some pause. So how do you validate the level of training, for example, at Kazakhstan University Medical School, that they are going to be safe for treating Oregonians?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bueller, obviously the board would go through a credentialing process to make sure that any physician was qualified to practice high-quality medicine in the state of Oregon. Otherwise, they would not approve a license if they did not at least meet, if not exceed, Oregon qualifications.
How would they do that?
They do it by going through a credentialing process to verify the educational process, what those standards are, where they go to medical school, whether it's Europe or in another state, and whether they're licensed, what their practice is, what their specialty is, what their residency was, what their fellowships may have been, to determine that. And then the university has its own obligation to assure that a physician is qualified to practice as well. So there's a double mechanism for assuring their qualifications.
I'm skeptical that OHSU or the Oregon Medical Board is going to vet the level of medical training at Kazakhstan University Medical School. How would that happen? What objective standards would you use?
They're looking to hire. These are highly rated faculty scientists. I mean, I think
I've seen it before in my training. I don't think adequate vetting many times can or is done of people. I have no concerns about a state origin, but international origin, I have significant concerns.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Green. Thank you for coming back and testifying. So the focus of the bill says state or country. Currently, my understanding, and certainly correct me if my understanding is incorrect, is that as a faculty member from countries of other origin or other countries, you can already do this for faculty staff. We're talking about allowing them to practice medicine on clients within that faculty practice or anywhere?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, I would encourage the representative from OHSU to please come forward. I don't want to give you an inaccurate response.
Okay. But I was asking from the medical board perspective.
But I think it would, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, I think it would be helpful for the university to express what their intent is, and then obviously the medical board is going to meet its obligation of only licensing individuals who are qualified to practice medicine in the state of Oregon, just like they do every day and every year.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, for the record, Julie Hanna with OHSU. I'm sorry, the question, could you repeat the question?
So my understanding is, I believe, currently that faculty from other countries, like we're talking about high-level faculty from other facilities, institutions, universities from abroad, have a pathway that they can come teach at our medical schools. Is that correct?
So this would allow them a pathway to practice as a faculty member at OHSU.
So the question is, can they currently come teach?
I'd have to get that information.
And they currently they teach, but they can't practice.
I believe they can teach, but they can't practice.
This is similar to the dental faculty that we.
That's my understanding. I believe that's correct. And there is a pathway that if they were to take the national boards to go through the process that all other physicians went through, that they could have an avenue to practice medicine, but this bill would be a alternative to that. Is that correct?
Just as we did with the dental faculty.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Well, that was a little different, though.
But that was to...
Well, the same.
No. Well, not what I recall.
Well, Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, so what this bill does is currently the physicians in Oregon are required to have taken the USMLE, which is a test that's given to physicians when they're graduating from medical school. And what this would do is allow the board to provide a medical license, a distinguished faculty license, to a limited number of individuals who meet other qualifications but did not get their medical license, did not get their medical degree in the United States.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill Senate Bill 684. I'm going to carry over a set of bills till Friday. Okay. I'll see if we can arrange to have a committee in their chairs for the whole meeting so we know what's going on. I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 684. Is that right, Sandy?
That's right.
I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 231.
Correct.
I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 284, is that? 283.
Correct.
I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 298.
Okay.
I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 430.
Correct.
I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 705.
Correct.
I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 833.
And then we reschedule.
Can I reschedule it? Do I need to carry it over?
No. We announced that we rescheduled 880 to Friday.
Okay. We'll reschedule 880 to Friday the 6th of June.
5th of June.
5th of June, and that has it all?
That is it.
We're adjourned.